Danny is the Holford Mackinder Professor of Geography at the School of Geography and the Environment at Oxford. Growing inequality is the greatest social threat of our times, he says. He has made social geography and the mapping of social inequality his life's work, I think it would be fair to say. And he recently moved back to his hometown of Oxford after spending many years in the north. So I'm sure that we'll be interested to talk to him about what he sees about the north-south divide. Danny's going to talk for a few minutes, and then I'm going to ask him some questions, and then I'm going to allow plenty of time for questions from the floor, because I'm sure that many of you have got questions. So do be thinking about the questions you want to ask. So without further ado, Danny, could you just give us your thesis, and then we'll
Okay, I'll do that. I'll stand up so you get a chance to see me for a bit at the back, and then I will cower again sitting down. For about two decades, there were many social scientists saying that there's a problem with inequality. And it was because inequality was growing. Inequality began growing in the 1970s, it grew rapidly in the 1980s. It carried on growing in the 90s at a slightly slower rate, but hardly perceptibly slower in hindsight. And it also grew in the noughties. Nick Clegg, in 2010, just before the general election in 2010, chided Labour because the inequality gap had actually grown between the best off fifth and the worst off fifth between 1997 and around about 2008. Nick Clegg then became Deputy Prime Minister, and the inequality gap actually grew faster under Nick and David Cameron. In a way, it is the reality of growing inequality that has brought inequality to the fore. Only one country, well two, Singapore, which is a very small country that I'm very happy to talk about, two countries in the rich world have greater inequality than we do, and the big one is the United States. And because we became used to what was happening in the United States, we didn't think we were quite as bad. But if you step back and you look at the richest 25 countries in the world, we are currently the third most unequal of those richest 25, and we are on course by just around 2030 to become the most unequal of the richest 25 countries, because our rate of inequality growth is faster than in the United States and in Singapore. In Singapore, they brought in laws to stop people buying flats and leaving them empty in the middle of Singapore, which we didn't do. In the United States, Barack Obama has actually raised taxes on the riches, so you're beginning to see a slight change there. And it only takes a slight change for the US to be knocked off. Now, because this has been gradual, because this has happened since the 1970s, we've been acclimatized to it. We didn't notice it one year after the other. There were particular events, there was a miners' strike. There was a time in 1995 when John Major couldn't answer a question on inequality in the House of Commons, and you can date his kind of decline from 1995 onwards. But in general, because the rise has been slow and steady, we think that where we're at now is normal. And I mean, I'm only going to talk for another 5 minutes about this, but I think the most important thing is realizing how abnormal we have become compared to how we used to be in the past, compared to other affluent countries, and what the repercussions of that are. All rich countries were very unequal about 100 years ago. They all had great houses with people who had servants, and the gap was remarkably similar. In all rich countries in the world, inequality fell from around about the time of the First World War through to the 1970s. The interesting thing is that different countries went in different directions from the 1970s onwards. We think they all went the same way. We're told they all went the same way. We're told it's technology, it's globalization, it's inevitable. Nobody ever tells you that the Swiss managed to control their 1%, so the 1% in Switzerland took less and less and less. So that in Switzerland now, a top banker is paid half as much as a top banker in London. You can get a house in Switzerland. It's still expensive, but you can get one and start a family at a relatively young age, as people used to be able to do in this country in the 1960s and 1970s. In the 1970s, we were the second most equal country in Europe. Only Sweden beat us. We are the most exceptional country for how we have hopped over country after country after country, and our best off have taken more and more, while people at the bottom have actually seen a real term decline in their standards of living, and since the crash has been a real term decline for the majority. The median family, the middle family in Britain, is living off an income of 5, 6, or 7,000 euros less than the median family in Germany or in France. So if you didn't know where you're going to be, you just knew you were going to be in the middle, and you have to pick somewhere to be, you shouldn't pick here. You'll actually be trying to get by with far, far less. And this is before you even take into account housing costs. And our housing costs are far higher than in Germany and France. Our houses are smaller and more pokey. But the message you're told is that France is a basket case. It's terrible. They don't know how to run an economy. Nobody tells you that the average family in France is actually better off. We've stopped being able to do that story for Germany now. There is no way you can point to Germany and say what a terrible country, what a mess it is now. You know, a country where it's so much cheaper to house yourself, where you can rent, half the population chooses to rent, and your landlord can't chuck you out unless they bribe you out. But the housing market still works. Where you don't have housing inflation, so the actual value of housing stays the same. That's because Germany is a more equal country, and it can happen there. Or the Netherlands, where the richest 1% take about 6.7% of all income. Here they take about 15%. It's more than one and a half NHSs a year. It's the biggest in Europe. But again, you might say, what, you know, why does it matter? They're creating wealth, they're creating jobs for other people, but they're creating much, much lower paid jobs than in other countries with much lower inequalities. They're creating jobs that people can actually live off. They're creating jobs where you don't need to have housing benefit to pay for your rent. Here, the gap between those who've got most and those who've got least has been growing progressively year on year. And you can feel it in all kinds of things. That the best way to feel it is simply in how young middle class people try to get a home and start a family, and the fact it is so hard to do that. They have to move down south to get jobs, because the majority of new full-time jobs are in the south. A huge and increasing number end up in London. And if you do really well, you can rent a room in London in a house of other young professionals without a sitting room. You can only buy a flat in London with some family money. It is impossible, no matter how good a job you get in London, to actually save the amount of money required to buy that flat. And one thing I try to do in the course of the 1% is have a lot of sympathy for people at the top. My publisher didn't want me to have sympathy for people at the top. But if you have a child who has done very well, and say they're in their late 30s or early 40s, and they're managing to get out of renting, it costs twice as much to rent in the south than to have a mortgage, so it makes sense to buy. You might have children, and you might like the idea that they can go to the same school and stay there, that kind of thing that we used to be able to do. You can only buy with some money from somebody like you. You lend them the money or give them the money. They buy that flat in a very dodgy part of London, or what used to be a very dodgy part of London. If and when the housing market crashes, they could have £100,000 negative equity within 2 months. It's going to happen to somebody. You know, unless history has changed, somebody at some point is going to be that fool who buys at the peak of this market. London is now the most expensive housing market on the planet, and going up by 15% a year. But people there say, oh, it's going to carry on forever. I mean, it really beggars belief that we have got to this position. It is because of the extremes of things. The European Union monitors how many people are very highly paid. In London, 2,200 bankers have an income of well over €1 million a year. The next highest number in Europe is 197 in Germany. People often say that if you were to curtail the incomes of people at the top, they would go somewhere else for a job. There are no other jobs for them to go to. Nobody else actually pays these salaries. But they would have to go to New York, and the Americans really don't want to give them all their banking jobs. It's got to a dangerous position. It has all kinds of ramifications for society. Putting all your eggs into the basket of saying, it's okay if we go back to an upstairs, downstairs world, it's okay if London begins to fill up with servants again. It's okay if the average family aren't doing that well and are looking forward to seeing their children having a lower standard of living than they have. Don't worry, the super rich will save us. Somehow they will do something that will make life better in the future and will sort everybody out. Somebody else will invent. You've got to think, what is it? What is it that they do? What does it do in industry? And eventually when you think, what is it that they do in industry, you go, oh, they invent a vacuum cleaner. That'll help. They invent a vacuum cleaner, but then after the vacuum cleaner becomes fairly successful, they move all the manufacturing of their vacuum cleaner offshore anyway. So even the super rich inventing a new kind of vacuum cleaner, which is slightly better than your last vacuum cleaner, doesn't actually save you. This is what worries me. It worries me personally. I have children. I can see no way, if things carry on as they are, that my children will necessarily do well. My children differ, all our children differ remarkably. My slightly trusting child might do okay. My child who's a bit calmer and more sensitive, that's the one that I worry about. And it's what's going to happen in a more unequal country, in a more unequal future, to people who are not completely driven to step over other people's bodies, if you like, to try to get to the top. Because if you don't get into the 1%, if you're in the 99%, you're going to find lots of things harder than the generation before found. The last thing I want to talk about is the North-South divide. And it's mainly because for about 20 years of my career, I measured and tried to draw the line of the North-South divide, and I had a big argument with the New Labour government. Labour claimed that they narrowed the North-South divide. We measured it in terms of unemployment and health and house prices, and said actually it's risen a little bit. You know, lots of things got better in the north. The middle of Leeds was done up. The middle of, if you put Birmingham in the north, it was done up. Manchester, partly because of a bomb in the Arndale Centre, but Manchester was done up. Even Sheffield, they ran out of space in Leeds and they came to Sheffield. They never got to Rotherham or Barnsley or Doncaster or Bradford, where there's still a hole. I think there's still a hole in the middle of Bradford. What's it gone? Oh, I'm out of touch. Wrong place. What's it going to be? A shopping centre. Just what we need. Just what we need. More shopping centres. Okay. Anyway, for 20 years I measured this in an argument. Since around about 2005, this has been entirely pointless. Nobody bothers to measure North-South divide anymore. Nobody bothers to sort of say, look at the changing gap in house prices. Look how the young and the fit are being drawn south. Look how if people become ill, if they split up and get divorced, or if they lose their jobs, or if they have a disabled child, too many, so they're over the benefit cap, we move them out from London to Stoke. If you present yourself as homeless in Oxford with a child, we try to house you in Birmingham. We don't have any houses for you in Oxford. That's where we send you. And where does Birmingham send them? Birmingham sends them to Liverpool. So we are actually moving population in both directions and dividing the country into two separate countries. A place for winners to say while they're winners, but they're not really winners because they're commuting longer and longer, they're in clogged up roads that don't work, and they're paying rent. Most of the housing that goes onto the market in the South East is now bought by landlords. These are professional landlords who own many houses. Landlords made about, I think it was 400 billion since 2007. Well, the country was getting poorer, the actual capital of landlords, not because they planned to, but because of cock-up. When the crash happened in 2007, the banks couldn't lend anymore, but people still have to move house. So instead of moving and buying, they moved and rented. When they moved and rented, the landlords could put the rents up, because people were saying, what's the rent? And with the extra money from the rents they got, they bought another house, and the rents went up more and more. And as the house prices went up, because the rents went up, the people who were renting couldn't buy. And this has turned into a vicious spiral in the south of England. So people now think it is normal to rent as a family. One in four of our families with children in England are now in the private rented sector. It was about 8 or 9% about 12 years ago. And that 89% were largely temporary. They weren't planning to be in the private rented sector. The problem of being in the private rented sector if you've got children is you can be evicted with 2 months' notice. And children have friends who they want to keep as friends. And this is one in four families. This now involves the middle class. This is a widespread problem. All these things are related. Essentially, if you do not control the 1%, there is always a 1%, they're very easy to divine, you know exactly how many there are. If you do not control people at the top of society, they will contain a disproportionate number of people who are greedy. They also might well contain some very nice people as well. But different countries control how much the people at the top get, and in those countries, which is most countries in the rich world, where the 1% get a lot less, everything else is much better organised. And it's partly because it takes an organised country to actually say, we really cannot afford for you to be taking more and more and more. The income share of the 1% has been rising since 2007. For the other 99% of the population, the gap has actually narrowed. We have become more equal. That's probably going to end with the cuts that are about to come. But you can't afford to do that. If you look at the super rich, I'll end on the super rich because not many people have sympathy for the super rich. The 1,000 richest families, they have doubled their wealth in the last 5 years. The cost of the 1,000 richest families is the equivalent of running 1,100 royal families with 12 palaces. But the royal family at least go out in the open buildings and they smile and wave and they do things for us. The 1,100 members of the super rich largely do not do much. And those that do are doing things like making the vacuum cleaner, which creates a lot of jobs in another country. And I think we've got to realise that something has gone badly wrong. It's gone out of control. We can't let it continue. It's distorting our society in all kinds of ways that we don't recognise, one of which is student loans. Why do we have these £9,000 a year student fees? Why are students going to have to pay back £50,000, possibly over £100,000 if they get a well-paid job? It's because if you're in the best off 1%, student loans are great because your kids don't need them. You just give them £9,000 and you don't have to pay high taxes for everybody else's child to go to university. In more equal countries in Europe, that is in almost every other, sorry, in every other country in Europe, if they have fees, they're lower. Many of them don't have fees because they organise things collectively because they see each other as being similar. And we've stopped seeing each other as being similar. And winding our way back from this is going to be very, very difficult. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Danny. Sorry, I should have introduced myself. For those who don't know me, my name's Ruth Pitt. I'm a TV producer and writer. And I have a particular interest in this subject, actually. But I wanted to perhaps start off by asking you a little bit about your own background, because you did grow up in Oxford and then you came north to go to University of Newcastle. What was it that prompted your interest in social mobility?
I had a granddad who was a geographer who made me draw maps. That's part of it. But I grew up in the 1%. I should come clean, just in the 1%. My father was a GP, he was a doctor. And back then, I was born in 1968, so this is the 70s. Doctors, head teachers, they're all in the 1%. His income, in today's terms, was about £50,000 a year. This made us one of the best off families in the area. And it's quite hard if you do work out you're well off compared to your peers, not to be interested in equality. It just so happened that we grew up on a roundabout which has people from the poorest fifth, the next fifth, the next fifth, and the richest fifth in Britain around that roundabout. And I was lucky in that way. And of course, if you grew up in the 1970s, and it can only happen to you if you grew up in the 1970s, you go to the same school as everybody else. That hadn't happened before. And I began to notice when I was quite young, 14, 15, 16, that what was happening to my friends depended much more on which part of that roundabout they came from than actually what they did. Some came from areas where the family didn't want them to go away. Now, they couldn't go to university, although only 2% of us, I think, went to university, because they had to stay. People had different ideas about what they were expected to do, and it was very divided. And of course, this was just my part of East Oxford. Down in the town, there were these strange people dressed up in bow ties and funny stuff, trashing bars. This is exactly the time when the Bull and the Club were playing in the city, and that made you acutely aware that there were people with a lot of money who did look down on all of you, even though all of us had these big divides within our school.
Okay. Well, I mean, you did choose that path of becoming a social geographer, and your books, Inequality and the 1% and Injustice, and you've written a dozen books, I think, but these two books are absolutely packed with statistics, which is your thing. In fact, you know, it's not so much a sort of ideological outpouring as a sort of overwhelming statistical argument to support your case. So, what I'd like to talk about in the time we've got, we were a little bit late starting, but what I'd like to talk about in the time we've got is, because you focus very much on the 1%, is who are the 1% and what's their nature, and then what the impact of the 1% is on the 99. Okay. So just to begin with, there is a big variation within the 1%, isn't there? So who are the poorest of the 1% and who are the richest?
Who are the richest? There's more variation within the 1% than there is in the other 99%. The 1% matter because since 2007, they've moved away from the rest. For the 100 years before that, the 1% travelled with the rest of 10%. They travelled together, they became relatively poorer together and richer together. When Margaret Thatcher was elected into office, the group just beneath the top 1% had 2.5 times average income. When she was ejected, due to Jeremy Howe, that group had 3 times average income. The 1% did much better, but they looked after the rest of the top 10%. Since 2007, that has changed. If you're below it, you've done worse, partly because child benefit has gone from people at the top. To get into the 1%, if you're on your own, you need an income of about 160,000. If there's two of you, you need about 200,000 a year before tax. So I've never had the guts to ask an audience yet to reveal themselves. Wealth, you need a free spare million. So that's not the value of your pension or the value of the house you live in, but if the value of your other property, your stocks or shares, is about 1 million, you get into the 1% by dint of your wealth.
Okay, and the ones at the very top end obviously are worth billions, and they're just another ball game altogether.
Well, they're just another ball game, and not just them. If you look at the super rich, which are 1,000 families, the Sunday Times does a wonderful job with some very amusing fawning journalism about how wonderful they are in it. Of the super rich 1,000 families, 500 of them live in London. 10 of them have a quarter of the income of all the super rich. So it's very easy to be in a super rich and not feel well off because of the inequalities in the super rich. There's one really nice person in the super rich, but there's a tiny note in the latest Sunday Times rich list that says he should be in the richest 1,000 families, but he's given away so much to charity he no longer qualifies. And I think, I've forgotten his name, I should start lauding him. But there's massive variation within. The average member of the 1% is on about an income of 300,000 a year. 160 might sound a lot to you, but imagine that you turn up in London, you get a starting job in Canary Wharf as a lawyer for 100,000, very rare, but you can do it. You get promoted after a few years and you're getting 160, and you try and buy a three-bed house in Fulham, which costs, I don't know, 800,000, 900,000. Your income's 160. You can't get a mortgage for a three-bed house in Fulham.
Isn't that part of the problem, that even the wealthy begin to believe that they are uniquely afflicted and that they're not wealthy enough and that they don't have enough money to go around?
Because they're competing with each other for the things they need. It's also obligatory in the 1% to use private education, which then, of course, the cost of private education has gone up and up. You can't use any old private school. And remember, the 1% are now all in the South. almost all. They used to be spread out across the country. They're 1% everywhere. You're concentrating in the south that the school fees are very, very high. It's, once you put the skiing trips in, and the skiing trips are obligatory because you don't want to be the poor kid at these schools, it's 50,000 a year. That's quarter of a million between for age 13 and 18. If you make the mistake of having four children and sending them all to Eton, that's a million. It'll just take a GP, a doctor now in Oxford. A doctor now in Oxford, a GP, will be getting just over 100,000 in real terms. Twice as much as my father got. But they're in the 3 or 4%, and they can only have a little house, because a financier commuting to London now gets the bigger house. So if you want to know why do doctors and junior doctors get a bit upset about proposals to cut their salaries, the proposals at the bottom were pretty, you know, dramatic, but now, why should a doctor on £100,000, you know, worry about going down to 90? It's because they're being asked to move down the pecking order to people who don't save lives but just save money, and potentially don't even save money. And if we could constrain ourselves better, then we wouldn't have to pay our doctors as much. They're only wanting this amount of money because they want a particular house in a particular area, and they only can't get it because other people are being paid more than them.
So a lot of it is about status, isn't it? So yeah. how do we spot the 1%? It's because they do, you know, it's about their houses and it's about consumption and it's yeah. about holidays and the richer you get about yachts as well.
Yeah, we have got much better at hiding our social positions than we used to. I have a lovely cartoon from the 1930s that has four men on a ladder who are all stepping down, and the one at the top has a top hat, and the working man has a cloth cap, and people actually had hats, and the one at the bottom is actually stepping into water and drowning, and it's about the problems of austerity in the 1930s. We've become much more self-conscious about our class position, so, you know, not wearing a tie, all that kind of thing, so it can be difficult. If you want to, postcode, just get somebody's postcode. Once you've got the postcode and you know the job, you can work out whether they can afford it to live there on the income, and then you can begin to work out what the family money is. But that's what you need, not from the clothes. And if you go to Kensington and Chelsea and Westminster, once people get very rich, they actually do dress down. But if you
vox pop, you say that, but in your book you talk a lot about, you know, the absolute conspicuous consumption of wealth. You know, that you talk about a billionaire who has gold-plated toilets in his jumbo jet.
Yes.
You know, you talk about, a friend was saying to me only today, in Monaco, you know, the super rich put their yachts along, yeah. you know, and there are signs saying don't come any closer and it's all private, but actually you can get very close you and can. They leave their doors open so you can see all the expensive
yes.
stuff.
You do get that. It's been better since 2008. If you remember just before 2007, there were lots of stories about bankers in London celebrating and buying a bottle of champagne for £30,000. Those stories have actually ended in Britain. We have a distaste of what's going on.
Yes, you refer to it as the end of fashionable greed. I'm not sure right. I agree with you actually there. If you go to London, it seems to me that greed yes. is still very fashionable.
It's fashionable, but it's more fashionable well amongst very rich immigrants. We often don't realise that proportionally we've had more rich immigrants than poor immigrants. That's why the Queen is now number 70 on the welfare. I'm always worried about the Queen and calling her. The family do come from other countries. That's her husband is not exactly British. But anyway, above her, 70 families have come in. The conspicuous consumption, though, is of people from other countries shipping their Ferraris in from the Middle East and then doing the spins on them and annoying people. The English have become a bit self-conscious about this.
Okay, so the English are a bit more sort of restrained, you might say. But you do talk about, you know, how fashions change, and you quote in one of your books Clive James, who makes the point that, you know, in centuries gone past, people used to wear cod pieces yeah. to sort of aggrandise themselves.
Oh, this is because Clive James wrote a wonderful piece in 2009.
Yeah, you're a big fan of Clive James.
I'm a huge fan, and I keep on quoting Clive James because you keep on thinking he's not going to be here. And thankfully, he carries on being. He's even apologised for being here recently. He wrote this piece in 2009 for the BBC about how conspicuous consumption of wealth will go out of fashion in the same way that the cod piece went out of fashion in Elizabethan England, I think, at one point, and how ridiculous it would look. I think his prediction is beginning to become true, in that people are aware that the bulk of the population are struggling, and that, you know, spending a lot of money doing up your mansion or painting it in a particular way that's particularly gaudy might not bring on people being very impressed about you. But at the same time, we're internationalising this, so we are bringing in, well, we're welcoming it, a large number of people with a lot of money. And if you like, plan A for the economy is, if we can get the other half of the global super rich to buy a flat in London, that'll keep the London housing market going for a little bit longer. If we can persuade them to buy two or three, that'll keep the housing market going longer. It won't house anybody. They won't actually use these flats very often. And we'll have more and more problems with homelessness in London. But at least we can keep our house prices up for a bit longer.
One of the things you talk about, I mean, you say people are becoming a little bit more sensitive to the fact that not everybody's as rich as them. But one of the things you talk about is the character of the 1%, and how wealth, you know, makes you think, you use the phrase, thinking you're great is more common among the rich. Yeah. So empathy is not something the rich are well known for.
No, levels of empathy and trust are much, much higher in more equal countries. And levels of empathy and trust. If we do a survey of asking you, would you trust somebody on the train to look after your bag if you're going to go to the toilet? Those are the kind of questions that are asked internationally. You'll find that here people are less, you know, most of us would still trust a stranger, but more of us wouldn't than on average. The good news is you can almost always trust that stranger, by the way, in case you're worrying. The other questions, which are lovely, are questions about, are you over average? I should ask, who's a better than average driver? Are you better looking than average? And these questions have been asked in different countries. People are most likely to say they're over average in the United States. They're least likely in France and Japan. We're a little bit like the United States, but not quite as crass as they are. But what you're getting at is the views about other people.
Yes, and that sort of failure that in a sense, as people get richer, they're more likely to think they've got rich because they're somehow special or cleverer than everybody
they
else.
They do that. They do two things. One is they don't think they've got that rich because they're comparing themselves with other people who've got a lot. And there's always people above you. When the curve is like this, you've got a lot more than you. But the other thing is you begin to get a justification, which goes, if I get this much, it must be because I'm worth this much. Why am I worth this much? I'm worth this much maybe because I was educated at a very high cost. What was the point of the high cost of that education? It was to teach me better, so I know more, and I've got better A levels, so I must be cleverer.
We know that intelligence is distributed at random throughout the community.
It's pretty random. This is a fascinating area. It is pretty random. And, I mean, the amazing thing is that we know that if your child at age 8 is in the best 10% of ability, probably because you spend some time chatting to that child and so on, it doesn't actually make any difference what school you send them to. If your child's in the bottom half of ability at age 8, spend money on them. They'll get A, B, B, A level. I'm being a bit cynical, but it's... what we also know, we've only just discovered, is that we do much better at things like maths than other countries. There's a very close correlation between economic inequality and how well we do in education. So in more equal countries, when you test people at age 15, 16, they're much better at maths than they are in this country. But what's really fascinating is that when you test them again at age 24, they're still very good at maths, whereas we're appalling. And what's happening in us in the US is that because society is becoming more and more competitive, we're spending more and more effort teaching people to get an A or an A star or a C at 15 or 16 in maths because it really matters. And we're not actually teaching them maths. Most people, the minute they've got their GCSE, that's it, I don't want to do maths again, it was horrible. And it was partly horrible because the poor teacher was trying to squeeze one more grade out of you at that point. And we thought that we've come to think that this is education. The end result is that when I hire researchers for the last 15 years, I routinely hire people from Europe because they can write computer code, they can draw maps, they can actually do stuff. And it, you know, it's absolutely galling. If you have children in England, and you look at what we're doing. We give people lots of A's and A stars, but we don't actually teach them how to do things, which is what you need to know to become better at doing it later.
Well, of course, you do talk about how the rich pay for their children's education, and they, in a sense, you call it more like sort of training to be rich.
It's training, but even then, I have lots of sympathy for the rich. I'll tell you, it's long enough since I did it. I did a day of teaching in Eton. And in the geography house in Eton, there was a blackboard. And on the blackboard, it has a list of who got A stars in geography last year and who got A's. Nobody gets a B. So every day for 2 years, these young men have to go past that blackboard, knowing that they're expected to get an A star or an A. Now, not all, particularly young men, who find things harder than young women, partly because puberty comes later, the pressure on them to get these A's and A stars is very high. Then if they don't get into Oxford and Cambridge from Eton, they failed. I taught a lot in Bristol who felt they'd failed. If you don't get into the right college in Oxford and Cambridge, then if you don't get the first, you're not seen as that good. And I am very glad that I am not in the 1%, and I'm very glad I'm not in the group of people who are pushing my children into that position where they are constantly being judged. And this is one change over time. In the 1970s, if you went to a top public school, you could be good at sport, or you could marry well, or if you were very slow, you could go into the guards and so on, or all straight into the city. Like Nigel Farage. Nigel Farage went to Dulwich, and I think he left at 16. There were all these other things you could do if you were very rich. You didn't have to excel academically. Now, if your parents have a lot of money, you have to excel academically at age 16 and 18, regardless of whether that is the right time for you. I think the group who are particularly damaged, I am very angry about how our poorest fifth are the poorest fifth in Western Europe, and we have people starving, and we have food banks again. I mean, who thought that was going to come back? That makes me angry, but I have sympathy for people in the 1%, because I don't think that their children have good lives either.
But you say you have sympathy for the 1%, but in a way, if I can sort of push you on this, it's almost, I think, as though you are demonising the 1%, and by implication, that sort of makes the poor seem as though they're an absolutely powerless, amorphous group, as if you don't give them enough credit. It's all because of the 1% that they've got so many problems.
I'm probably guilty of that.
And you more or less say that, as the 1% get richer, then everybody else commensurately gets poorer, and there's no way of changing that.
Oh, no, we changed it in the past. Other places change it. It's not easy to change. The fastest way to become a more equal country is to lose a war. That's why Germany is such a more equal country, because your elite lose their property. The invading armies decide that all the cities should have a purpose. Japan is the most extreme example of this. The Americans made Japan equal. They took land off the aristocracy and disputed it out. A brilliant experiment. It resulted in the Japanese, who had one of the lowest life expectancies in the rich world in the 1920s and 30s, having the highest life expectancy. Japan has a 90% middle class, which is a 90% working class. It's the same thing. The poor and the middle can do a lot, but they don't get many opportunities to do a lot. So we have a particularly high abstention rate. People don't vote so often in unequal countries. They don't get given much of a choice. The US has only two political parties. Until recently, we had 2.5, really, in this country. But when people get a chance, they do. The Scottish referendum is the best example that people will turn out and vote if they think they're being offered something that really is different. But I'm also interested in what people in the middle do, and people in the rest of the top 10% do. Because for the first time in 100 years, the financial interests of the 1% and the rest of the 10% are not allied to each other anymore. The 1% are not benefiting or trickling down to the group immediately beneath them, because they don't need them as much as they needed them before. And that group have been very powerful in British society. The top 10% vote, and they can carry other voters with them. If things are getting worse for people in the top 10%, the potential to actually have this shift to say it's gone too far is much higher. Because the alternative is for people in the top 10% to say, please can we have a little bit more of your money? We don't mind you ripping off the other 90% of society, but can we join in as well? Give us one more grammar school in Kent, or whatever it is. I probably shouldn't have raised grammar schools, if I will. And I think this is where we are with politics in Britain. It's the haves who really are 1%, the might-haves, who are possibly the next quarter of society, and the have-nots, who are at least 3/4.
Okay, so you talk about the sort of last point I'll come to before I come to questions. You talk about how, you know, the very small section at the top are sort of, as they take more, they are depriving everybody else, and that's in terms of housing opportunity, you know, living conditions, opportunities for the young. I mean, you say quite rightly that the young are disproportionately affected by poverty, education, health, all these things. So my last question to you is, what was your feeling about the general election result, and what do you imagine is going to happen in the next 5 years? Are things going to get worse? What's going to happen by 2020?
Oh, his last question could be 2020, that's ages away. Everything suddenly become very interesting since 2007. We sort of thought it was interesting before, but when you look back, you know, it was pretty steady change in one direction. I didn't, and nobody else predicted that election result. About 4 people stuck blogs up trying to pretend they had them afterwards with a pack dated. Nobody predicted that. It was the most amazing election result. Very narrow win, very small majority. For the first time ever in the democratic history of any rich nation, just 25% of the electorate have managed to elect a majority government. It's not happened anywhere else in the rich world. It has happened in Colombia. In Colombia, where 2/3 of people don't vote, 18% of electors once did get a government in, but it's precarious. It's not, the idea that people are saying, oh, 2020 is sorted because of this, it's 1 in 4 voters. Many of them voting very reluctantly and shyly and out of fear in places like Nuneaton, because they weren't sure what's going to
happen. So are you saying that it's not going to take much of a shift for the political landscape to change?
We know the political landscape's going to change, because we are about to have a referendum on one of the most important issues to affect us. Which potentially will split the Conservative Party, maybe not if they're very disciplined. What it will also do is tell lots of people from mainland Europe that they're not particularly liked here, more than they already think they're not liked. If you are a young, successful, as the vast majority of people from Europe, mainland Europe here are, with 2 or 3 degrees, and you have to live through 1.5 years of a referendum saying how terrible you are, why not go back to Paris, or go back to Berlin, or go to Bonn, or go to the Netherlands? I think there's quite a good scope to put people off. If that referendum ends up with a vote to leave Europe, then suddenly a large number of people cannot come here. Another group of people who are already here will definitely think it's time to leave a country that really doesn't want you.
You mean the wealthy?
No, not necessarily the wealthy. They've got outposts everywhere. So if you're truly wealthy, you have homes and money places, and you move your money around, and you pay. Well, the really
so
wealthy.
So the super rich would stay coming to London, irrespective of the.
They'll stay while we let them. The super rich employ people in the 1% to look after their money. A classic job. The 1% is now 97% finance. A classic job of somebody paid £200,000 a year is you're an investor for a member of the super rich, and you move the money around to keep on 10% returns a year. If we were to vote to leave Europe, I think that's what would trigger the housing crash. Because you're voting to deny a whole set of people coming into the country. And it's housing demand. The only reason we have a lack of housing in the country is immigration. We haven't been having 2 babies per couple since around about the time I was born. It's only net immigration that actually increases the demand for housing now. So if we want to, you know, if you want to bring on the housing crash and see what happened, vote to leave Europe and see what a mess you're going to put the Conservative Party in after that vote. Anything could happen in 2020. just like anything could have happened at the Scottish independent referendum in the end.
Well, we certainly live in interesting times. Okay, we'd like to take some questions. There's a gentleman here, well, gosh, there's lots of hands going up already. I thought that was happening. We did start 10 minutes late, so I'll go on for a little bit. So if anyone needs to creep out, that's fine. Thank you.
We seem a bit short on solutions.
Can you just start again? Yeah. The microphone wasn't on.
We seem a bit short on solutions, what to do about this.
Okay.
I have two systems which I'd like to comment on. One is, everybody say how much they earn publicly. This happens in schools in England, and it happened in Ethiopia where I worked. We knew what everybody earned. Second, and much more important, is that if you want to deal with climate change, which you've not mentioned, which is the other major problem, a carbon tax on the carbon you emit on everybody would hit the rich a lot more than the poor, normally because of the boats and the yachts and the large houses and the flying all over the world. Surely the introduction of a carbon tax on every emission that we make would be a very important development.
Thank you. Two very good solutions.
I agree with them. They're radical. You can do smaller things. Most people on EasyJet and Ryanair flights are ABC, social class, by the way, it's not the poor. There's a very strong correlation between consumption and inequality. The most unequal rich country, the US, you need four planets if everybody behaves like people behave in the US. In the most equal Japan, you just need two. Still one planet more than we've got. But people in more unequal countries buy more things they don't need and throw them away more often. The average item of clothing is worn 12 times in this country. It's very easy to work that out. On the declaring your income, this happens in Sweden. In Sweden, incomes are public. It takes you a long time to get to that point. It helps check for tax avoidance, because you can actually see what your neighbour is saying their income is, and you can count how many Land Rovers they have outside their house. I would aim to get towards there, but before then, on solutions, I just head towards a normal European top rate of tax. It's only about 55%, it's not much of a raise. And I would give people normal European rights as tenants, not to be evicted as fast. The minute you do that, the value of housing begins to go down, because it's not worth landlords buying the houses so much. If you can get the cost of housing to begin to fall in this country towards a German level, ideally in my utopia by just 1% a year, nice and gradually, that's very hard to get. It's the equivalent of every trade union winning their pay bargaining every year for all of their members, and everybody's not in a trade union, because everybody has to pay for housing. For young people, the green issue is the most important. More equal countries, people consume less individually because they're happier with what they got, and they're not tricked into buying things that they don't need.
Thank you very much. Okay, so if you can keep your answers brief, because we've
got... Thanks for a very interesting talk. I agree with your description of the situation, but I'm not so sure about who to blame for it. I spent the last 30 years living in Germany and Holland, and one thing I notice is the culture, particularly, I don't know if I'm using the term correctly, but the working class people, the level of education of working class people is much higher in Germany and Holland, and therefore they work more. So that reduces the inequality. Now, I don't know that it's necessarily the 1% that is blame for the culture, if that's the... I'm giving away what I think. The culture in England that creates the situation we have here.
Yeah, the cultures are closely related to inequality levels. So as inequality rises, you have less respect for people at the bottom, and you end up with some more respect for people who have a lot of money. When our inequality fell from 1914 all the way through to the 50s and 60s, we put much more emphasis on the education that everybody was getting. We introduced free secondary education for everybody. We then decided that there weren't bronze, silver and gold children. You know, everybody should have a good education. Germany, even though it has a split education system, you're put into different tracks at different ages, has respect for working class Germans and tries to give them a very good education as well as the middle class. So when you become more unequal, it's very hard to value people at the bottom. So I'll just annoy you once more. When you make that decision about opening up a new grammar school, what you're really choosing to do is to open up three new secondary moderns. Why would you choose to have more secondary moderns? It's because you think there are a group of people in Kent who are not up to anything other than being lackeys for you. And it's only possible to see other people like that if you've grown so far apart. The reason I'm cynical about the grammar school is it's not for the people at the top. They wouldn't touch a grammar school. They only touch private education. This is all for about our education for our children. They also don't touch a mortgage. You don't, at the very top, you don't borrow money to buy a house. You buy it with cash. Mortgages are for the little people.
Food for thought. Okay, I'll take a question there and then a question at the back.
Thank you. Just by complete coincidence, it's also relates to Germany. You mentioned about more equal countries being, affected by the war. But I think it's very interesting about Germany that who became very unequal after the Berlin Wall came down. And I think it's very interesting that, because I did live in Germany myself after that period, and I know that a lot of middle class people were moaning about paying higher taxes and so on. But nevertheless, they managed it, and then in a single weekend, a few weeks ago, Germany accepted more migrants than the Tories sort of generously agreed to up to in the next year or so. So what I'm interested in is, obviously it's very interesting structurally how they managed to do it, and accommodate them in housing and education, but what I'm really interested in is how do they get politically that to make it acceptable, because it's not that it's the Germans are more naturally welcoming,
Interesting. None of this stuff is natural. The lovely thing about the fact we've had these different issues is that we were more equal than Germany in the 70s. There's nothing inherently natural in a group. People often like to talk about the Anglo-Saxon family and so on. And migration-wise, we are very similar to the Germans. When the war went down, there were big inequalities between the Eastern Land and the rest of Germany. Germany had the second biggest health inequalities and life expectancy in Europe because things were so bad with pollution and other things on the east. But the country with the biggest inequalities in life expectancy was us. It was as if we'd had a war. The life expectancy gap in Britain between the north and Scotland and the south is bigger than the one between the east and the west of Germany. And the German gap has now narrowed because they taxed the population in the west and did things in the east because they knew what a shock it would be in the east of what had just happened. If you've just grown up under one political system and suddenly everything you've told is true stops being true, it is difficult. We did it before, after the First World War, not just because of the First World War, although the taxes of that war made the rich poorer. Somebody had to pay for that war. It was trade unions arguing for rights. It was suffragettes arguing that women were more equal. It was a general strike. It was a crash in 1929. Immediately after the crash in 1929, people at the top of society tried to get back to what they'd had before 1929. It took until the mid-30s to realise that something fundamentally had changed. But the key thing that happened in this period was that a group of young people, largely young men, after 1929, came to the side that their parents' generation had got it wrong. It was made easy for them to come to the side their parents' generation had got it wrong because they were made to go and fight in the Second World War. And it was kind of one World War's excusable, but allowing the second one to happen. That generation, the generation who built more council houses in the 50s, in a Conservative government than the Labour government had done, it's that generation in the 60s who brought in equal schooling, it's that generation who got decent benefits, it's that generation who worried about Cathy Comes Home. And what that generation had done is reject the thinking of their parents. If something's going to happen in Britain, we're going to have to do something truly awful to young people, like saddle the half of young women who go to university with a massive debt that they can never repay, provide them with only precarious jobs, tell them it's their own fault when they can't get a good one, and hope they don't talk to each other. And if they talk to each other, I think there's a generation of young people, we're not sending them to war, but we haven't set things up well for them. And I can see a degree of anger rising in that.
You could argue in many ways that it's the children of those 1930s parents, the baby boomers, who pulled up the drawbridge after them. But that's another question. There's a question at the back.
Oh, hi, Danny. Even if inequality is a problem, the right would say it doesn't matter because a rising tide raises all boats.
Yeah.
So, do you have an argument against that?
Thank you.
Okay, the argument against the rising tide. They're kind of on their own. You know, Obama has talked against it. The Communist President of China, maybe understandably, has talked against it. The Pope, written 40,000 words, partly, saying this. Christine Lagarde, you know, it's almost becoming passé to say inequality is a problem and the rising tide doesn't lift all boats, because we've tested this method. We gave the boats different chances. We threw the water in and we saw what happened. And what actually happened in the US far more and in Britain is that the little boats all sank.
Isn't a trickle-down effect, in other words?
There isn't a trickle-down, except you could theoretically have trickle-down in one country. This is the fear. You can't. It doesn't work globally. We've tried and tested it and it doesn't happen. But we could go for being the place with the cheapest property taxes in the world, which we are. We could go for opening up our schools and our universities to very large numbers of very well-paying overseas students of the super, super rich, which we're doing. We could revert back to what we were 100 years ago, when the most common job for women was to be a servant. And we could do upstairs, downstairs and Downton Abbey again, but not for the English aristocracy, for the aristocracy of the world. It's an option. And
you make the point in your book that even the servants of the super rich, their relative income is falling.
Their income is falling, and also they like bringing their own servants in. One thing that happens in Singapore, there are 100,000 maids who are largely brought in. They're not given rights. They are pregnancy tested every 3 months now. It used to be every 6 months. All 100,000 of them. And if you're pregnant, you have to leave Singapore. This is why Singapore doesn't boast about having the lowest infant mortality rate in the world, which is interesting. We have suggestions here. Nicholas Soames made a suggestion in the House of Commons a couple of years ago that we should drop our borders, only have a guest worker scheme like Singapore, allow people in, but they mustn't have their children. He didn't say how we're going to stop that. He didn't actually say we'll pregnancy test, but how else do you do it? There is a plan for trickle down in one country, and it doesn't actually involve our children, because you can bring in servants are much better behaved if they haven't got any rights. I know it's something a bit extreme here, but after 30 years of moving in one direction, you do have to look at where that would take you in another 30 years if you carried on doing it. And I just don't think we're going to do it. I don't think you can let half the young women of England go to university and hope that they can't work out that they're not all going to be the winner, you know, that it's not going to happen for them. And people do not bring up their children wanting them to be chauffeurs for people in Westminster, wanting to work as security. We have a million people now working as security guards. You know, you get more and more security guards in an unequal country. Is it that much of a fun job to spend your life guarding a door for somebody?
Thank you. There's a question here and then a question there, and that will have to be it, I'm afraid.
I wonder if the fact that George Osborne is spending so much time talking about the Northern Powerhouse now mean that he is wondering if he can make a difference to this North-South divide before everything goes pear-shaped. Or am I being too suspicious?
Can I ask that one first, because I'm remembering? George Osborne has turned out to be a remarkably good politician, which was a surprise to me. He was in charge of the last election campaign, and he won it. It wasn't Lyndon Crosby. As Chancellor, George spent more money in his budget, every single budget from 2010, on one thing rather than anything else, and that was measures to boost the housing market. Helped to buy loads of them. But each budget, more was spent on that. By getting the housing market to be up and rising, it partly helped support his vote. His eye is on winning 2020 again. It may be personal. You may think it's going to be him. And he knows that all he's got to do is get the conditions in place to make it look like they are the most sensible alternative. His problem is that he stoked the housing market up so high, it's now gone above the Tokyo market, that there's a good chance, it's very hard to see how he's going to keep it safe for another 5 years. He'll no doubt, when it does crash, he'll blame it on Jeremy Corbyn having said something and wrecked the market. The Northern powerhouse is pitiful. That's what I have to say about the... I do agree with local councils being allowed to band together and act in their own self-interest, not least because I lived for 10 years in Newcastle. And in Newcastle, the Northern General Hospital was allowed to die. If the Northern General had been kept going, the whole west end of Newcastle could have been kept going. So, and only people in Newcastle would understand that. So I'm in favour of this kind of thing, but the amount of money is absolutely tiny.
Insufficient. Okay, yeah. Thank you. Last question here.
Danny, I'm a dry stone roller, so I'm definitely not part of the 1%. However, my partner, she's French, and she's a junior doctor in Bradford Hospital, and I can assure you that as not part of the 1%, if that EU vote goes the wrong way, I'll be on the boat with her. However, going back to housing, will a crash in London within the M25 bring us all down?
Yes, it's a great question. I may be obsessed by housing, but it's got so out of kilter. What one effect of, I mean, London, you're now looking at an average price of £500,000 for the whole London, including Barkingham, Dagenham. Oxford Economic Forecasts say, and they believe this, they say the average price will be £1 million by 2030 for a house in London. One effect of this is to make price rises elsewhere, like here, look reasonable. But a house in Ilkley is not going for a reasonable price. It is not a price that an average family could actually aspire to afford here. The same thing's happened in Leeds and so on. Prices have gone up to be 5 or 6 times incomes, and nobody bats an eyelid about that because where I come from in Oxford, they're 15 times incomes. You know, so how can you complain about your house prices? One reason why the prices have gone up everywhere, well, Help to Buy stopped any falls anywhere, is that the soaring London market makes it impossible for people to believe that the impossible will happen and everything will carry on going up. The minute you get London going, and it's always London that goes first, you'll then have people stopping for a second and saying, hold on, am I going to buy that terrace in Ilkley with 3 bedrooms for this much, or shall I just wait a year? And the minute they wait a year, and you need to move out to that flat that you're trying to get out to, it's circular, it'll build on itself. This happened in the rest of Europe. Prices halved in Ireland, they halved in Portugal, they halved in Greece, they halved all the way around the edge of Europe, up to Iceland. They halved in Northern Ireland. The only place they didn't halve was England. And it's partly our stubbornness. We really don't like selling our houses for less. But it's also our government's action. And it wasn't just the Conservatives. In 2009, I was asked to come to number 11. And I came to number 11 Downing Street. And I said, why do you want to see me? And they said, because we want to see if you've noticed what we've done. And I said, I haven't noticed what you've done. Tell me, what have you done? They said, we've taken half the regional aid money away. And we put it into the mortgage rescue scheme for the south of England. That's the last act of New Labour. Because they were petrified that the housing market in the south of England was going to collapse in 2009. So Labour began it, but when you think that things are safe, just think about the actions that politicians took to try to keep things stable, and how by taking that action and making our housing more expensive than it has ever been, they've actually put us in a really precarious position that could hit us individually if it happens to be at the time when we are trying to make a move when this crash occurs. And the more it goes up, the bigger the crash will be. The only equivalent to London in recent history is Tokyo in the late 1980s, 90s. The Tokyo crash, prices halved in a few years in Tokyo, and then they stayed at that level. That's the only thing we have to compare what will happen if London carries on for a few more years. rising at this rate.
That's a suitably apocalyptic note. I thought we might also end on a quote that I heard from the Labour MP Jess Phillips, interviewed on the Today programme recently. She said, "We're all better off when we're all better off," and I think you probably agree with that. Danny will be signing books now. I'm sorry we've started and finished a bit late, but thank you very much to you for coming along, and thanks, Danny.